Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. Along with John, KC2WGB, John and Dick attempt to analyze, organize this very enthusiastic crew of guys that meet most Sunday evenings at 8 o'clock on this repeater for discussing their favorite subject, ham radio, and related subjects to ham radio. The subjects appropriate for the TechNet are usually almost any subject that would be of interest to ham radio operators. It's my belief that a true ham radio operator is a bit of a scientist trapped into a body that doesn't have the doctorate degree yet, so to speak. So they got lots of curiosity, and by way of this net, people in the tri-state area get together, trade information. Let me drop. And bear in mind that there is no guarantee that all you're going to hear is 100% accurate. A bunch of people will speak with great authority, occasionally I'm one of them, and the good news is that it's kind of a peer-reviewed information by way of the website that's assembled by this very enthusiastic guy, Mike Perry, KC2NJI, and you can go to that website at www.amateurradio.tangovictor. There, the last 6.5 years of the TechNet are recorded. Most of them are documented as to what subject was discussed during each 10 minutes. And by way of that publicly available past information as to what took place on the TechNet, a person can listen to anything they want to, so to speak. You can select by subject as well as by date, by hour, by minute of that hour. And if any of us say a significant error, quite often we'll get an email real fast, somebody telling us, hey, you're crazy, it ain't X, it's Y. So by way of the peer review, we eventually correct most of the errors, it says here. No guarantee that the price is right. A realistic person knows that no matter how sincere you are, every engineer, every scientist, every person doing any kind of research has a certain batting average. Nobody bats 1,000. There's going to be a certain error rate in everything you do. In the case of the error rate we have in driving automobiles, hopefully you've got a sturdy car and you've left enough space between you and the guy in front and so on. So most of those errors are not really significant, it says here. The person signs into the technical net because he does have a question or a comment for the net by giving John and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this, KD2BHY, Jim and yes. Jim is a frequent person who signs in. So give me a call letters and name right now. K2LAW listening.
WA2PJF, yes.
BHY, yes.
Stupid comment.
Okay. The person who didn't give us our name at first was Vito. Good thing I know Vito from Bayshore. Jim, we got you as number 2. So we got Vito and Jim. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
And 2HN off the pole.
Okay, we got
WS2N. Paul. Good evening, Dick. With the space report.
Very fine, Paul. Paul and I met face to face for the first time late last night at the Limark field day operation, and what a short little guy Paul is. That's a joke. I think he's about 6'4". All right, we've got Wes, Paul.
You should have a little arrow next to it to let you know it's on.
Yeah, it's on right now.
It was off. Yeah, that's nice. Yeah.
Okay, we've got Jim, Paul, Wes, and Vito. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
W2EEC, Chris, no question.
Paul. Okay, we got you, Chris, with a no. Anyone else? One last call.
KD2CGM, Norman.
Is that Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Golf, Mike? And that's Norman. And I think you're saying you do have a question or a comment, Norman, go ahead.
No question, just listening.
Okay, another no. All right, so Vito was number 1 on the runway. And you might also tell us, after your question, Vito, where were you during the field day operation? Whiskey Alpha 2, pilot jet fighter. That's what I like to use as phonetics for Vito, KQRW. Go ahead, Vito.
Yes, okay, good evening. This is Vito, WA2PJF. Are you copying me okay, Dick?
Loud and clear, please proceed.
Very well. Okay, very well, I'm sorry. I was at the Great South Bay Hamfest today. It's only right down the road from where I live, even though I am no longer a member of that club, and the Limewalk one is a little too far for me to travel, but I am a member of that one. So anyway, that's the situation with that. My question, if I may, last Hamfest we had outdoors at Limewalk, and I did purchase a vintage communications receiver, a Hamon HQ120. The gentleman told me it was not in working condition, but I bought it anyway only because it was pristine in cosmetics, not a mark on it. It was missing one thing, the carton from the factory. That's the shape it's in. Let me drop. I don't know if I can drop or not. Anyway, my question is, a good friend of mine, Jimmy Kohler in Freeport, who's a very good receiver repairman, repaired the receiver for me. It was very in-depth work, and I didn't want to get involved in it. It was filter capacitor. He changed every capacitor in the circuit, every one. A lot of the resistors, our tolerance were changed. My question, my problem is that the receiver does drift, and after about 45 minutes, it stabilizes about 95% of the way. I was reading that the next step, and that's where the question comes in, the next step is the voltage from varying voltage will affect the oscillator, the voltage regulator tube, possibly the power supply tube, the 5Y3, the oscillator itself, the 6J7, should be replaced, our original. If I do, I ordered these tubes, by the way, they're in transit now. If they do...
Yeah, I'm getting him about an S2 in my area. I heard people in the Queens area saying he's quite strong there and he's mobile. So, Dennis, I bet you, you're not accomplishing very much. Alrighty, Vito's main question was his beautiful, pristine HQ120 receiver, which looks like it's brand new in the box, has a drifting problem. And he's asking, could the voltage regulator, which is sometimes a voltage regulating tube, could that be it? And by putting a voltmeter across that tube when it's operating, you would get a hint. Part of what's going on here, Vito, I think, I'm going to guess that 90% of the drifts that you're seeing is due to the fact that an HQ120X receiver does drift. We all forget about the days when we didn't have frequency synthesized our transmitters and receivers. In the old days, every radio you ever owned for the first 30 minutes or so would continuously drift very fast at first and slower later on. Every receiver I have ever owned had a drifting problem. The permeability tuned oscillators of a Drake, of a Collins receiver had a lot less drift, but they still drifted. And along comes frequency synthesizers with a reference 10 megacycle crystal, for instance. And all of a sudden, as long as the crystal is doing its job correctly, there is essentially no drift. A few hertz, but nothing like the 5 and 10 KC of drift that we used to experience. So vintage radios all had drift, Vito, and after you do enough research, there's probably some websites you can go to. I think we're going to be timing this out pretty soon. So we'll have to just wait it in for the machine to reset. After you do enough research on websites and talk about and look up the HQ120...
Timeout.
When you look up the HQ120, the 129X, and all those other receivers, there's probably a website where the fans of the HQ series of receivers, Hamelin receivers, will tell you how much drift that they experienced. And the drift in kilohertz was considerably higher on the higher bands. In other words, the amount of drift you experience on 10 meters would be considerably greater than the amount of drift you would experience on 80 meters. It's proportional to frequency, but they all had it. yes, it's a good idea to change the tubes and to check the voltage regulator and whatever. However, I think you're going to find that even when everything is exactly as it was the day it left the factory, you're going to be amazed how much drift we all used to tolerate on the older radios. Another thing you're going to discover is that all of the power supply capacitors in those days, which usually were electrolytic capacitors, they didn't have a perfect hermetic seal on the bottom of the capacitor. Therefore, they do all slowly dry out. And therefore, after about 10 years or so, the electrolytic capacitors that are on, say, a Heathkit afterburner amplifier or any of these older tube-type rigs, all of those capacitors eventually start going very low in microfarads of capacitance. You start developing quite a bit of hum in the power supplies and so on, and replacing those is a good thing. So you're experiencing what very few of us remember anymore, Vito, because of our modern-day synthesizers and modern-day methods of making capacitors, which essentially don't require replacement and no longer have any drift. So as you do further research, I think you're going to discover that you're not going to be able to eliminate all of the drift. Maybe some of it, but you're going to be amazed how much is going to remain. That's just the way those rigs worked in those days. I'll be turning it back to you, Vito. You'll hear a lot of noise as soon as I drop the carrier. Just talk over top of it. You overpower him. On top of that, even if you don't, I can hear you perfectly on the input, because in Bay Shore, you're in my backyard. WA2, Papa Juliet Foxtrot, K2RIW. You got it, Vito.
Okay, very well. WA2, PJS, returning. Very well, all the things you told me, I have researched. I read everything, and all the things you've said, I have read the same, and more or less, I've been advised to get used to it. But, okay, yes, I had a very loud hum that was replaced by replacing the, gotten rid of entirely by replacing the filter capacitors, and like I said, all the capacitors in the complete circuit, 25 or 30 of them, were all changed. And a lot of resistors, as I mentioned, were out of tolerance. They've been changed as well. We're down to tubes now. So, okay. So that...
Okay, Vito did have quite a bit of hum in his power supply from the HQ120 until all of those AC electrolytic capacitors were replaced. And then after that, essentially all the hum disappeared. Quite a bit of that drift is going to stay there, Vito, but there's at least two things you can do. Ed just signed in, K2TJE, and told us that if you leave the filament turned on the tube all the time, in other words, rewire things in such a way that when you turn it off, the filament stays on, that will eliminate a lot of the drift. Also, one of the things that the factory never did that you could do is to put a fancy capacitor across the voltage-controlled oscillator. The main tuning oscillator is something that you can modify by using negative coefficient capacitors. If you choose the right size negative coefficient capacitor and put it across the power supply, the capacitor as the total receiver warms up, the negative coefficient capacitor will change its amount of picofarads, and if you got the right size across the circuit, it'll change in the right direction by the right amount and make an awful lot of the drift disappear. The factory didn't see that. Turns out that the actual phase lock loop oscillators of a modern receiver the actual components that go into it are not very expensive. So you could build your own oscillator and substitute in that receiver and have zero drift. I didn't say it's the right way to go. It's not gonna be a vintage receiver anymore, but that's one of the possibilities you can go to. Alrighty, good luck with that project, Vito, and let us know how it turns out when you change the tubes.
Learning how to tune it, so I'm back to you, Jim. KD2BHY, KQRIW on the tech man.
If you're going to
Yes.
Yeah, thanks, Vic. I was just wondering when I'd learned from Hal and I had the internet reassured of that when you between the drive control, what you do is you computer and the ALC, then maybe the ALC, then the drive until you see a maximum meter reading. Now, I wasn't seeing anything on the meter at all when I had done that. I was just staying at zero, and there wasn't any movement in the little meter. I was kind of curious about what might be happening, and if anyone knows.
Let me turn the camera.
At least one of those controls requires peaking. You have to swing it back and forth until you get the maximum deflection. You have to have the meter set the right way so that it's really indicating whether or not the right amount of drive is getting to the final stage. You've got a drive control, a drive tuning control, even before you get to the plate tuning and loading controls. So there is a particular tune-up procedure that rig requires. I wonder if you own the owner's manual for that rig, Jim. Tell me whether or not you got the owner's manual, because I think that would help a lot. KD2BHY, K2RIW.
The manual, and I have I told me the same thing that they told me on the internet, so I didn't. ALC and tune and start the transmitting, and the meter didn't move, so I was just kind of curious about maybe there's something wrong, or I'm probably wrong, but I hadn't checked the manual, and I think that's something I definitely should have done earlier.
Yeah, one of the things you got to remember, Jim, is that a single sideband transmitter in the single sideband mode, until somebody is whistling or speaking into the microphone, there is no signal flowing through the rig. Many of these rigs do have a tune mode, which is sort of like the Morse code mode, where it does put through a continuous carrier, a low amplitude continuous carrier during tuning. But in the case of a single sideband rig, when nothing is coming into the microphone, there will be no drive. To make some plate current being drawn by the final stage, control grid bias, that with the right setting of the meter can be read, but there will be no signal coming through until you speak into the microphone or whistle into the microphone. So finding the right tune control, finding out whether or not you're going to be doing the tuning by whistling into the mic, these are some of the things that hopefully the manual will help. So I think you said you do own the manual and you just haven't read that section yet. Is that sort of what you're saying, Jim? KD2BHY, K2RIW, and SecNet?
Yeah, I read the thing, but, I just... when I just turn the carrier, there's a carrier function, I turn that... I wasn't talking into the microphone. Knob. And I noticed that when I moved around the
Vicky's
at my house. That's an awfully angry. I'm getting a, as I said, S3. I think I heard some of you guys are getting a 30 over 9. And the fact that it's not exactly 1 to 1. So, I have to tell you, not to get a that it's not all working perfectly at all. I'm going to stand by for a little while, because next person on the list. With Paul, and I noticed that the 375-975 is not connected at this time. Paul and I would get in by that 975 and 375. KQRW standing by.
KC2WGB with a comment for Vito. People listening, when you get a chance to
go right ahead, John.
You're gonna cam somebody, cam that fucking asshole Wesley. Leave Dick alone, he's a nice guy.
Oh, KC2WGB.
Dick,
radio basically have on. So if they were going to use it, say, on a Saturday, they would turn it on.
How about you, rugged?
hitting DC.
I'll mention that to you later. I want you to get a chance. Right now, I don't think Jim.
I'm going to go.
to know the length of your top and toe.
Test. The link back up, Dick, one more switch.
Switch your RAW testing on 375. Okay, looks like we got a possible way here. Switch your RAW trying to continue. The Vito, if you're still listening, one of the suggestions that John just made was that he remembers in the old days people used to put a diode in series with a 110-volt line to the HQ120 receiver to run it at the half voltage and keep it warm when they're not using it, and therefore when they turned it on full blast later on, they had a hell of a lot less drift. That's one approach. I think a serious guy nowadays would either put a negative coefficient capacitor or take some experimenting to find the right value across the actual oscillator coil, or just simply replace the whole oscillator with a modern-day phase lock loop. The actual integrated circuit for a phase lock loop system is a $3 part, so to speak. Yeah, setting up the printed circuit board and wiring it in there, I'll admit that would be a considerable amount of rigmarole, but that's another possible approach. Either that or various ways of letting it stay warm so that you know there's drift there when it starts off cold. Just don't let it get cold. Just leave it leave the oscillator section on, if you know what I mean. Let's see how we're coming through. Oh, yeah, we're coming through okay. Paul, if you're able to get on 147.375, 975, we can go over to your question and or the space report. And by the way, I did see that the Voyager spacecraft is a report that's now it's about to cross over the threshold between the solar system and the rest of space. They can tell because they're getting a sudden increase in the number of cosmic rays that it sees. In other words, they're starting to leave the magnetic field of the sun. They can tell because the cosmic rays are no longer being deflected. And the Voyager is now 80 billion kilometers, I think is the number. It is 3 times the distance of Pluto away. Round trip time is 33 hours and some number of minutes at the speed of light. To communicate with Voyager now at the speed of light, to hear your own signal coming back on that transponder system is 33 and a fraction hours. And it's 3 times the distance of Pluto. And both Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 are about at the same distance. So if you can get on the 975-375 repeater here, please give us either a space report or your question. WS2N, nice meeting you yesterday at the field day site at Limon, K2RIW. You got a call. WS2N, if you're there, K2RIW, go through the 147.375 call. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I switched over. Very good, Dick. Okay, you mentioned Voyager. Well, yeah, Voyager 1 is much further ahead than Voyager 2. I think Voyager 2 is like 9 billion miles that way. The other one is 11 billion. So, by the way, hot copy. This is WS2N.
I'm copying you extremely well, Paul. I flipped the wrong switch. That's why it took me a long time to come back to you. I'm copying you very well, so please proceed.
Okay, fine business then. Nice meeting you as well. And, very good. Yeah, I think I left about 15 minutes before you. That was my son-in-law that was with me. Also I am. KQ2WMR. The Voyager, yes, it's like 128 U out. So, you know, compare that to 39 AU, you know, with Pluto. But yeah, like you said, about 3 times or so out. And I did read there's actually a website. They keep a constant flow of information on how far both voyages are, as well as the AU and also the time. So, yeah, it's roughly about 32 hours round trip now for Voyager 1. So, they had Ed Stone on National Public Radio last Friday. He's
he's been involved with his Voyager program like from the beginning. He's charged over at JPL. And he had mentioned the SID rays, and we dropped it. Is 160 bits per second. So, I mean, that's way, I mean, I that's got to be, I mean, definitely 1970 technology. But with the three deep space networks set up 120 degrees apart around the Earth, they can keep in constant contact if they want. They usually do about 8 hours a day, he said. Interesting, he didn't mention that they still got 20 watts left on the transmitter. That's still pushing out 20 watts. All cameras are shut down. They shut the down cameras years ago, over 10 years ago. When they did that, they took pictures of all the planets. Looked back, took a whole mosaic of the planets, Earth, Mars, and all in the background. And then they said, well, we need the memory space. There's not much on board to do what we want to do for interstellar work when we travel. So no more cameras work, forever will work. They expect it to go to around 2020. So it does have the RTG power supply, the radio, what is it, radio isotope, thermoelectric generator, still kicking. Half-life of the plutonium-238 is 88 years. And this was all mentioned on Friday on that science show I listened to on radio. And he said 88 years for the half-life. The problem is the electronics. Everything, something else is going to fail. They think something will fail by 2020. They're hoping to get that far. But it looks like it has reached the heliosphere and maybe beyond. Dick, do you want to continue with this Voyager, or do we have a couple more topics?
At your choice, that Paul, that's a darn good subject. That is the furthest flung piece of hardware that mankind has ever produced. Essentially three times the distance of Pluto. It's hard to imagine. And at the speed of light, 33 hours. I mean, the guys who do moonbounds, they're amazed by the fact that from the time you push down the key and you send the signal up to the moon, it bounces up the moon and comes back, there's a 2.5 second delay at the speed of light because it's 250,000 miles out to the moon. So ham radio operators are enthralled by the 2.5 second delay line to the moon. Can you imagine 33.5 hours of delay line to the Voyager spacecraft and back? And the reason you have to do that, if you were setting up a receiver and you only had a bandwidth of the receiver of roughly 160 bits per second of data read, means you're making the receiver by way of digital signal processing. You're making the receiver more and more narrow, so you get a good enough signal to noise ratio. As it gets that far away, inverse square law, the signal's getting super weak. We're talking about something like a minus 160 dBm signal. And your signal generator doesn't go anywhere near down that far. 40, 50, 60 dB further than you can get out of the signal generator in weakness without leakage of the cabinet. So when you get down that far, the receiver's got to be very narrow. But when the receiver is that narrow, getting the exact frequency would be almost impossible. And the way that transponder works, let me drop. The deep space network is such that you first send a signal up to the satellite. The satellite receives your uplink signal, phase locks itself to it, does a division, in other words, beats it down to an IF frequency, but does a division of 240 over 221, which is a 1.08 ratio, roughly. In other words, it uses your uplink signal as the frequency reference, and it reestablishes a frequency using that as a reference that's 8% higher in frequency and sends it back down. The advantage of doing that is you don't have any crystals on board, per se. You don't have to worry about the aging of the crystal, the drift of the crystal, the warm-up time when you turn on the rig and it drifts across the band. You know, at 8.5 gigahertz where the thing is working, you could easily drift by 5 kilohertz. You try to find a signal in a 160 hertz bandwidth filter while 5 kilohertz of drifting is taking place, not counting Doppler, it would be very, very difficult. It uses the uplink as a reference, send it back down. That's why everybody talks about round trip time. I mean, a mighty person would say, why don't we just talk about the one-way trip? But if the satellite is talking to you, it's one way. Not really. It doesn't talk to you until you talk to it. It uses your uplink signal as a frequency reference. On top of that, by carefully counting every cycle of what comes down, each cycle at 8 gigahertz is about an inch and a quarter. So every cycle that you count coming back down gives you the exact range rate to the nearest quarter of an inch, inch and a quarter. It's a really fantastic system that Deep Space Network, the DSN. So give us any more information you want to about what Art Stone has to say about this anniversary of the Voyager, or the next piece of space information. The choice is yours, Paul. WS2N, K2RAW in the deck.
Question on that topic, six. Oh, very, very good. This is WS2N. Ed Stone, by the way, E.D. Stone. Just a related topic, the NEMO project, that's the one that they sent Aquanauts down in, under the sea for a couple weeks at a time. And I mentioned a little bit of it last night too, but this, the habitat they're living in is called Aquarius, so they're doing experiments. They want to see what it's like to send astronauts to asteroids. Difficult problem. There's virtually no gravity, or very so little that, you know, when you're going to land on it, you're going to get out of your spacecraft, you're going to just touch one rock and you're going to float away. So they need to set all these kinds of pedestals on the ground and figure out ways of doing it. That's one of the things they're doing down there. But talking to mission control throughout the whole mission, except for an interview with Bolden, and I think they spoke to the International Space Station. They wanted delay time, up to maybe 10, 15 minutes, similar to what it would be if they were on asteroids. And they simulated a medical emergency, what they're going to do, trying to talk to ground control. And one of the things that they found useful is text message. They're kind of used to it. Send a message to somebody, sometimes 10, 15 minutes later, you might get a message back, or maybe an hour later. So they are dealing with it with text messaging on quite a bit of that mission. That's why I mentioned that, the dropping. And I saw a few last night about the voice, by the way, on Nemo, and I did hear another couple of interviews. One was Steve Squires, a lot of us are familiar with that. I know you are. With him, he was head engineer for the Mars Spirit and Opportunity mission, and now an Aquanaut, and involved with that, doing testing down under the sea. And the interview with him, he was on board station. His voice is the same. I still have to figure out what percentage of oxygen, nitrogen, whatever it is, breathing down there, what it is. We know they're down at 63 feet, 2.5 atmospheres. So, two pieces of real information is the China mission. They sent three people to their own space station. It's very small right now. It's just the size of the old Salyut 7 from the Russians. It's basically one gigantic tubular structure, about 11 feet diameter, maybe 30 feet long. Drop it. The three Talconauts, instead of astronauts, the cosmonauts, the astronauts will live on the space station for only about 10 days. It's kind of like a temporary space station, similar to the early Salyut space stations that the Russians had. It will be replaced by a permanent station around 2020. That's their plan. The space station is called Tiangong, T-I-A-N-G-O-N-G, Tiangong 1, and it's there. Put up there a while back, and the first manned mission to it. Actually, you got two men and one woman. They plan on another flight later this year. And they're gung-ho with they call it the 921 space initiative, from China. Joint 921. 92, they got from the year they came up with this, back in 1992, they developed their space program. And the one was for the 1st of August, when he planned on sending the first person to space.
They've already done the fourth manned mission. Things get moving along. Here was our space program, either government or private. Yeah. Always keep ahead of the other countries, of the drivers. The other big news is the, not related to space, but the physics, Ken spoke about yesterday, but we'll bring it up again. The Higgs boson particles believed to be found by the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva. They even got a possible electron bulk measurement or weight of it. I haven't heard it yet, but I mean, this is supposed to match July 4th. I don't know why they're putting July 4th, but I guess we are somewhat involved in it, but I don't think it, I can't imagine being related to 4th of July, but they found this particle, sometimes called the God particle. The physicists, they say, hate when you call it the God particle, but I kind of like it. I think it keeps the general public interested in the multi-billion dollar project that's going in Geneva. 17-mile ring. I mean, they got the biggest one. We had one here on Long Island, 2.5 miles in circumference. The Isabel project, also over to the Rifra project, the relativistic heavy ion collider. And we also had one in Chicago, near Chicago in Illinois. But now the big one, of course, in Geneva. We're going to have the biggest one. It's going to be around 50 miles. Back in the Bush administration, first George Bush, there was a couple of $1 billion invested into it. They were building it down in Texas, but they did do away with that. And that would have been a monster. But they're doing good science here and could lead to further investigation into supersymmetry, which is really yet to be proved. Other particles that have people with opposite charges or something. I forget what the deal is with supersymmetry, but it's a whole investigation that's going to probably take place once they have the data on the Higgs boson. And also different dimensions and all, and if they really get involved, maybe even with dark matter. One guy I heard talk about it, Travis, believes that the dark matter and his boat is with his weak particles, weak interacting mass of particle, whatever it is, and whence they call it. That's his boat. But I'm also speaking on a science show that I was listening to last week. So that's it. That's the information there. I've got one launch to the into the International Space Station Expedition 32 that'll take place mid-July. Back to you, Dick. WSY.
I'm guessing the mid-July will be SpaceX as the company, that commercial company that's doing very well. When you talk about the Voyager putting out 20 watts, I think the Traveling Wave 2, when it was brand new, put out 10 watts, and I think it slowly aged down to about 6 watts of output of the Traveling Wave 2 of the transmitter, which was launched in, 1976, I think it was. Is the 20-watt number that you're talking about, Paul, could that be the power output of the nuclear power generator? That the DC power output is 20 watts. I'm having trouble believing that the RF transmitter at 8.5 gigs is putting out 20 watts. And I know that they're turning off a lot of things as the power output of the power supply goes down. And I think one of the Voyagers lost one of its oscillators on one of its detectors, so it doesn't do the same amount of detecting it used to do. Back to you for some correction on that, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Okay, yeah, if you were interviewing Ed Stone or me, I would definitely push you further on that question. But, you know, it's a science show for the general public. Ira Plato's in it. You know, was asking some of the questions. And he was more interested in, you know, how are you receiving this feeble signal? He says, what is it, a couple of watts? What is it? And the other guy, Ed Stone, in charge of this Voyager deal, said that it was 20 watts. So, yeah, I mean, he didn't say it was 20 watts. He said it is a 20-watt transmitter.
I'm talking about the output of the RTG. But is this 20-watt transmitter sending a signal? You know, and they talk about it a little bit, you know. Even Ira Plato, he's been around for a long time, by the way, that guy. And he's some science shows on TV. Newton's Apple on public TV. And he asked him, he said, you know, you've got 50,000-watt radio stations down and transmitting it on AM. They could barely get around, you know, the city. How could the 20-watt signal now that you can put 20 watts in there? Yeah. So, I mean, this went back and forth a couple of times. So I was curious, but that's what they said. And I'll have to go with that until I hear a different thing. Back to you.
The super well-tuned traveling road tubes for space could be running as much as 33% overall efficiency, in which case the power output would be one-third of the power input. If they're putting 20 watts into the transmitter assembly and 6 watts is coming out and going to the antenna, I believe that. I don't think that tube ran 20 watts in the very beginning. So I think he's talking about input power is my best guess. And he's keeping it simple. And from his point of view, he's really got to play power management. You got to decide which functions to turn on when, because the nuclear power supply, DC output, is decreasing in time. Not only because of the plutonium itself and its half-life characteristics, but the actual thermal generators slowly degrade because they're being irradiated with nuclear particles, so they go down in efficiency. So the power supply slowly falls off. So I am guessing when you and I do a little bit more digging, we might find the 20 watts is input power to the transmitter, not output power. I think there's a chance we're going to confirm that it's running something like 6 watts of output. But 6 watts of output from, what is it now, 80 billion miles, 80 billion kilometers, really down the road a piece, which proves to you that every time you double the distance, you fall off 4 to 1 in power output. That's the so-called inverse square law, 6 dB or 4 to 1 in power. And because they were smart enough to set up the system so that it was reprogrammable after launch, and now they're down to a more narrow bit rate, very similar to what the moonbound ham radio operators do. When your signal is super, a lot slower, and a carefully tuned set of ears can suck that signal out of the noise, the slow speed CW. Well, in the case of digital data, 160 bits per second is about the slowest anybody has ever dreamed about. I mean, the earliest computers that we ever had that had an acoustic setup coupling to the telephone line, I don't think any of those ran slower than about 60 bits per second. And all more narrow band receivers, he hears less and less noise and still hears that weak signal. So if you can make Dr. Tom Williams of the A1 MBA, if you had a super narrow feed on to moonbound. Maybe the answer is yes. The signal is narrow enough and the receiver is narrow enough. Every time you half the bandwidth of the receiver, you can hear a signal of half the power output. And it'll still give you approximately the same signal-to-noise ratio. That's